The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture, titled The Gaonim of Israel and the Renaissance of the Hebrew Language, is dedicated to the memory and le'ilui nishmas Reb Aaron ben Reb Yaakov Meir Olav HaShalom, Mr. Aaron Friedman, of blessed memory.
In the previous lectures of the series, we have concentrated on Babylon Bubble, its scholars, its literary works, and its impact upon the world. In this lecture, we will focus our attention on the land of Israel during the Gaonic era. As we pointed out in a previous lecture, towards the end of the period of the Rabbonim Tzavaroi, from the reign of Justinian in the middle of the 6th century, the study of Torah in Israel was outlawed by the Byzantine emperors. The state of affairs lasts until the defeat of the Byzantine forces, first by the Persians, and then finally by the Arabs, year 634, 640. But the Jews have always been masters of survival, and even in the most severe circumstances, they managed to transmit Torah and even create new literary works. I hope all of you have your handouts. On page 1, in paragraph A, we quote a document found in the Cairo Geniza, the archives of the Ben Ezra Synagogue in Fustat, Old Cairo. We've discussed the impact of those findings in a previous lecture. In this document, which dates from the end of the 8th century, Pirkoi ben Baboy, a disciple of Rav Yehudoi Goin, quotes his master. It reads, Rav Yehudoi, of blessed memory, said that Byzantium decreed Shmad, with forced assimilation on the land of Israel. They should not recite Shema and they shouldn't pray. This is in the year 553. They did let them, however, enter the synagogue to sing Ma'amodos, the Piyutim and the Krovos. That, in other words, unconventional prayer they did allow. But they wanted to outlaw traditional prayer. So they would say Amaimed, they would say Piyutim, and then slip in Kedusha and Shema. As they did this clandestinely. So they told them they're not really praying. They're just reciting poetry. But in the process, they snuck in some of the elements. They did this, of course, only during duress. Rav Yehudoi Goin goes on to say that now the times have changed. There's no reason to have Shema connected with Kedusha. And according to this, even though we brought a different source in the previous lecture, according to this, the origin of why we say Shema and the Musaf of the Kedusha on Shabbos is really a retention of the old times when the only way they could say Shema is sneaking it in. And that's how they said Shema in Eretz Yisrael during this period. Rav Yehudoi Goin felt that since the times have changed, there's no reason to continue this second saying of the Shema. But it gives us historically a look into that period. In addition, and this is also taken from the Cairo Geniza, from the writings of Pirkei ben Baboy, in paragraph B, the evil kingdom of Edom, this Byzantium, decreed Shmad, this forced assimilation on the land of Israel, that they not read the Torah. So they forbade the reading of the Torah. They subsequently hid all the Sifrei Torah because they would burn them. Again, it gives us an inkling of the times. Of course, when the Arabs came and allowed freedom of religion, all of this did not apply. But there was a deficiency of Sifrei Torah. Because, of course, even though the Jews managed to hide some, of course, some were burned. There weren't enough Sifrei Torah. And they didn't have, at that time, scribes with a practical knowledge of knowing of how to, not the writing so much as the finishing of the hides. Rudoy going complained that the way that's done in Eretz Yisrael, in Israel, in his times, again, was a throwback to the ignorance that they had to make do and process hides the same way that the Arabs processed hides to write the Quran. And he felt that this was incorrect according to halacha. But again, that's a halachic question if the way they process hides in Eretz Yisrael is valid or not. But one thing we see is that during the time of the Byzantine Empire, that really not only the davening but the studying of Torah was forbidden, and they actually burned the Sifrei Torah. So it gives us a sense of what actually occurred then. It was in the same era that the piyutim, the religious poetry, was introduced. As we know of the piyutim of Eliezer ben Kalir, of Yanai ben Yanai, we devoted a whole lecture to this last year. Under the watchful eyes of the censors, the sages of Israel created religious poems filled not just with religious sentiment, but actually with Torah content. In the words of Yehuda of Barcelona, in a Sefer Hoitim, which was in the 13th century, according to what we've seen written from our rabbis, the piyutim that the world is accustomed to say were only instituted at a time of shmad, of forced assimilation. Because they were unable to mention words of Torah due to the decree that the enemies imposed upon the Jews, which forbade the learning of Torah, the sages amongst them instituted the piyutim as part of the prayers in order to mention and alert the common people regarding the laws of the holidays and Shabbos and the minutiae in the form of praises and thanks and stanzas and poems. In other words, they snuck into the poetry, which they did allow, all these halachas, all these laws. And again, it shows us that really the Jews, and they did this really openly. The authorities knew that they were doing this, but they didn't understand what they were doing. But it seems besides that which they openly did to counter the measures of the Byzantines, which the thrust of them, of course, was to force them to convert to Christianity. But it seems that clandestinely, yeshivas were also functioning. And we know yeshivas were functioning in communist Russia, under the watchful eyes of the communists. Yeshivas were functioning in Israel as well. We know that on page 2, this is from the Seder Olam Zutra, which we've quoted before many times, Mar Zutra, the son of Mar Zutra Reish Galusa. And we have this whole story how the Reish Galusa Mar Zutra really created an army. And his army was vanquished by the Persians. And at that time, the whole family of the Reish Galusa had to hide. Mar Zutra, after 30 years of hiding, went up to Eretz Yisrael and became a Rosh Yeshiva. The Reish Pirka, which is in Aramaic, which means a Rosh Yeshiva. According to Rav Isaac Halevi, this occurred in the year 588. You know, this was in the midst of these Byzantine decrees. We had yeshivas functioning. And if you read this is a list of his descendants. And it seems that it's a list of those who were in positions of leadership. And it lasted, at least the writing of this, until number 42, Rav Pinchas, and number 43, Rav Chatzuv, were descendants of this Mar Zutra. The son of Mar Zutra was the Rosh Yeshiva. It's not clear what the positions of all of these people were, but we know from the Cairo Geniza of one of the Rosh Yeshivas during this period of time, Rav Pinchas, in the 8th century. So it would seem to be this Rav Pinchas who was his descendant, was Rosh Hashiva, and it would seem then that his position of leadership was connected with being the heads of the yeshivas. During the Byzantine era, of course, having yeshiva meant having a clandestine yeshiva. But Jews evidently were able to learn. The next source we have of scholarship, at least of the names of scholars in Eretz Yisrael, we have on page 2 in paragraph D, which again we've discussed in the previous lecture, Rav Achav Shavka, Rav Achoy Goin, the author of the She'iltas. When his student became the Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Natroi Kahana ben Mar Rav Muna, Rav Acha should have been the Rosh Yeshiva, but the Reish Galusa, Rav Shlomo Bar Chisdoi, had strained relations with him, chose his understudy, chose his disciple instead, and Rav Acha felt that it wasn't that it was time for him to leave, and he went to Eretz Yisrael. What he did in Eretz Yisrael, we don't know. But the time of his coming seems to be roughly the time that Rav Pinchas was the Rosh Yeshiva. What he did and what his influence is really only left for speculation. As far as literary contributions of that period, besides the Piyutim, we've studied the Piyutim of Eliezer Talir, of Yanai Bar Yanai, we know of several works of halacha which were created in this early period of the Gaonim. One of them is quoted in the Tshuva of Rav Haigoin on page 2. Commenting on the Halachos Gedolos, which is a major compendium of halacha which we've discussed in the previous lecture, author Rav Shimon says Kiara, he maintains that one of the sources of the Halachos Gedolos, referring to a specific issue in halacha, was taken from the Sefer HaMaasim of those who live in Eretz Yisrael. Maasim, it seems to have a thing like Maisa, refers to halachas, of psukim, of rulings. There was a work of rulings which was created by scholars in Eretz Yisrael, which predated Rav Shimon Kaira. It seems it predated the Baal Halacha, the Halachas Psukos of Yudai Goin, and this was actually one of his sources. This work, we only know of the mention in this tshuva, but at least we have fragments of that work were discovered in the Cairo Geniza. And it's interesting, from the language of the Sefer Maisim, it seems that scholars maintain not only says how it fits in, but actually when it was created. One thing, it's written in Hebrew, which is really the language that was spoken in Eretz Yisrael by scholars. It was different than in Babel, which Aramaic was used all the way through the Gaonic period and beyond. After the period of the Talmud, it seems during the Byzantine era, when the Greeks really put their put pressure on them, the Aramaic ceased to be the language of the Jews. And evidently they didn't feel comfortable speaking Greek. That was the language of the oppressors. And it seems to be a renaissance of the Hebrew language. The works were created in this post-Talmudic period are written in Hebrew. However, there is much Greek added into this Hebrew, because Greek was the language of the street. And as scholars point out, that many of the Greek words used in what we've discovered, these fragments of the Sefer HaMaasim, are not the Greek that are quotes from Midrashim or from the Talmud Yerushalmi, which also, because the language of the Romans then, in Israel, was not Latin, was Greek. So we do find much Greek in the Talmud Yerushalmi and in the Midrashim, which are created in the Talmudic period. But their words are not even mentioned, Greek words that we don't find the parallel. Evidently, it's not a quote from the Talmud, but actually the author is using his own words because this represents the words that were being used. So it's really, we find that this, it was authored during the Byzantine period, which seems again to the credit of the Jews, that not only were they have yeshivas under the watchful eyes of the Byzantine emperors, but they were actually creating halachic works. Another work which was found in the Sefer Geniza was called the Hilchos Treifos, which is a list of the laws of treifos, of the non-kosher the animals, which seem to, for the scholars point out, that seem to follow the rulings again of the Eretz Yisrael scholars, as we find, but not the Babylonian scholars. This was the fact that the Talmud Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud, became universally accepted is something which occurred in the middle of the Gaonic era, but not early on in the Gaonic era. As Tosos himself points out, Rav Eliezer HaKalir, the poet, which we've placed towards the middle of the end of the middle of the 8th century, relies solely on the Talmud Yerushalmi, on the Israel version of the Talmud, not the Babylonian version. It was only much later that the Babylonian version became the accepted final psak. But the early works that we find really represent the earlier view of the Israeli scholars, which are based on the Talmud Yerushalmi. There's also a fascinating list, which seems to be written by an author early on in the Gaonic period, the list of the different minhagim, of customs, between those who live in Israel and those who live in Babylon. From a historic viewpoint, it's fascinating. This is all found in the Cairo Geniza. Besides these works, of course, they found in the Cairo Geniza's translations of the Halachos Gedolos in Hebrew, because Hebrew, again, was the language spoken in Israel, no longer Aramaic. There's a work similar to the Shiltas, based, in other words, in terms of style on the Shiltas. Let's see, in Taz here, also written in Hebrew, a product of Eretz Yisrael, of Eretz Yisrael scholarship. Again, we don't know who their authors were, but we did find the fragments or parts of it in the Cairo Geniza. But there are major works that we do have. They're printed in the standard Talmud Bavli. They're printed in the at the end of Masechet Avodah Zarah, the tract of Avodah Zarah. That's a Hilchos Sofrim, the laws about writing a Sefer Torah. The other Masechet Ketanos, Tzitzis, Gerim, Avodim. These are all, it seems, according to the scholars, were produced in the early Gaonic period in Eretz Yisrael. Of the later Gaonic period, as up until now we've discussed the early period, the Byzantine oppression, finally the Muslims conquered the land, allowed religious freedom. We've discussed at least partial lists, it seems, of Rosh Yeshivas, of luminaries of the period. Some of the works are produced during this period, but after that early period, there seems to be a silence. At least we don't have much information of what occurred. It begins to open up again in the 10th and 11th centuries. On page 3, we quote, is a fascinating response, a tshuva, that it's reworded, it's paraphrased, but it's a tshuva taken from a responsa sent from the yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael to the community of Rhine, which it seems to be in Worms. It was this tshuva, this originally work, was found in Worms, Germany, where this was the place where, you know, in the as we're going to see in the next lecture. Which was a major Torah center. The community, let's read this on page 3. The community of the Rhine asked of the yeshiva of the land of Israel in the year 960 to reply about a report they had heard about the coming of Mashiach. It's interesting, and this is in a lecture that we're going to have in 4 weeks, that in Spain, Fisdoy Ben Shafrut, who was the foreign minister of the king of Spain, sent a letter to the king of the Khazars. The Khazar was a kingdom of Jewish converts near the Volga River, and asked him, this also around the same day, did you hear anything about the coming of Mashiach? Evidently there was this rumor that was going on during this period. So they asked about the coming of Mashiach and also about the status of a sircha, a lesion to the heart. In other words, when they opened the animal, they found fatty tissue. This is by the heart, connectless to the side of the animal. The response was, this is fascinating, regarding the coming of Mashiach, you're not worthy of receiving an answer. Don't you believe in the words of the sages and the signs they predicted? The signs have not materialized. Well, if you don't see, these aren't the signs, don't even think about giving any validity to the rumors. Regarding a sircha to the heart, we who are the major Sanhedrin, listen how they refer to themselves, this is year 960, the major Sanhedrin, the minor Sanhedrin, we find the same use in a response from Rav Amram Gaon. Rav Amram Gaon is already in the middle of the 800s. The major Sanhedrin refers to the 70 scholars who made up the first tier in the yeshiva in Babylon. The minor Sanhedrin are the ones, the rows following. You know, how there were like seven rows in the Babylonian yeshiva. Each row had 10 seats. Behind those seven rows, there were several other rows of minor scholars. If there would be a vacancy, the vacancy would be filled by those of the rows that came behind, from the eighth row and on. The same wording, though, is used in the yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael. Evidently, they looked at themselves not just a place of learning, but as a Sanhedrin. As we pointed out, the difference being that the yeshiva is a place where Torah is taught, it's transmitted. The Sanhedrin, or that was the function of the Mesiftas, of the Surim Pumpadisa, it was acted as a conclave of all the great scholars. Not just the scholars teach their students, but the great scholars come together to deal with the issues and to the understanding of the teachings. It seems that practice was already in the year 960 was followed in Israel. But interestingly, they quote as they're quoting now. They're finding a source to this, in which they're relating to the community in Worms, of the Psak, the ruling of Yaakov bar Mordechai, the Rosh Hashiva of Sura. This is, he was Rosh Hashiva from 798 to 812. And all of his generation signed a letter allowing a sircha to the heart. So they quoted them not on their own learning, but on basis of the ruling of the Babylonian yeshiva. So it seems that they still view themselves to be, and this is dependent on them and inferior to them. They also wrote the Rhine community, it would be better had they written them questions. And don't ask us such stupid questions. Ask us regarding the profundities of the tractates of Yevamos and Erevin, those are difficult tractates of the Talmud, rather than the simple questions. And then they ended with greetings of peace for those of the, you know, for those in the Rhine community who inquire of their welfare. But evidently there was a functioning mesifta. It's not just a yeshiva, not just a place where scholars get taught, but where scholars gathered. But during this period of time, it seems that the Bubble still had, or at least tried to maintain its predominant position. And this we have in paragraph G on page 3. This is a letter from Rav Shririgo that he is sending to the yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael. Request from the Rosh Yeshiva that he should issue a command that this letter be read publicly. This honor was accorded there to our ancestors on many occasions, so too should this be done now. And ever, as we went through last, you know, in the last lecture, Rav Shrier wanted to reactivate and put a primacy to the position of the yeshiva in Babylon after it had fallen in decline. And he wanted to reassert himself. Don't delay, let us know that our desire was fulfilled, that the letter was read to the people. However, this struggle about this predominance, we find continuing on here on page, this is in paragraph H. This was after he wrote this letter. This is after the year 960, in the year, this is 1006. We find that Rav Haigon was complaining, this is a letter which we quoted last time, to the community of Keruin in North Africa, that they stopped sending them letters, for they have subordinated themselves to the group of scholars in the land of Israel. The scholars of Morocco were now looking to Israel for guidance and not Babylon. And finally, as we quoted last time, this is on top of page 4, we find that the yeshivas, again, we quoted just now that they call themselves the great Sanhedrin, the minor Sanhedrin, they also call their yeshiva, this is Gaon Yaakov, as we find at the end, and they gave all these wonderful titles to the Rosh Yeshiva. This is Avram, they call them Gaon. This is Gaon Savram, the Rosh Yeshiva of Gaon Yaakov. Eretz Yisrael, during this period of time, this is already the 11th century, are beginning to assert themselves and becoming, what is an equal to the Masifta in Babel. Finally, this is just a fascinating. As we stated before, towards the end of the period of the Gaonim, the Talmud Bavli, the Babylonian version, and their rulings were the accepted rulings in Eretz Yisrael. Rashi, who lived already in the 11th century, in his commentary to Masechta Temura, Tractate Temura, deals with two versions, two different manuscripts of the Talmud, on the question of what's more authoritative. One was the Yerushalmi version, and one is the Bavli version. Evidently, these are two manuscripts of the Talmud, the Babylonian Talmud, one produced in Israel for the Israeli yeshiva, and another manuscript produced in Babylon for the Babylonian yeshiva. Rashi seems to have copies of both versions, and he quotes both of them. But here they are really producing the Talmud Bavli, and really they are vying versions, and Rashi himself is not saying which one is the correct one. He just brings both of them. So again, we just have this, what we've gone through is shown that even in the worst times, Talmudic scholarship was maintained in Israel. They produced many works of note, even though we may not necessarily know all the names of the great scholars. In fact, to the extent that they became, of a sort, a balancing force, a competing force, amongst world Jewry, in terms of their prestige and their rulings of law. However, one name, which again was discovered in the Cairo Geniza, shines forth during the second half of the Gaonic era. And that's the name of Aaron ben Meyers on page 4. And again, everything, as we said before, was discovered in the Cairo Geniza, the archives of the Ben Ezra Synagogue in Futstock, Old Cairo. This is a list on the bottom of page 4 of the Rosh Yeshivas in, they had a whole list of the Rosh Yeshivas in Eretz Yisrael. We have to realize what they've discovered. These are shemes. These are fragments. This was taken in the archives of the shul. It was just, so it was probably worn out even before it was put in. And one of the problems, the challenges facing scholars is not only to make, even if they had a complete document, you know, to understand it, but when you have a partial document, really they may have been like worn to begin with, or because of infestation, there are holes in the document, there are parts missing. How do you fill in the gaps? This is a fragment of a document. It begins in the bottom page, for Rav Yosef HaKohen Goyin, the son of the sister of Aaron ben Bar Moshe ben Meir. Evidently, Ben Meir is a family name. He's always called Ben Meir, but very often people are called for their grandfathers. At the time of this Rav Aaron, and I'm referring to this Rav Aaron, the sons of Rav Tzemach Hanossi, the Rosh Yeshiva, who this person is, had a quarrel. He was from, if you look at the original Hebrew, when it says Mibnei, that was not in the original. That is the scholar trying to fill in the blanks. The mem was there, and there's enough letters to put a B'nai in there from the sons of, but it's still not all that clear. And again, Rabbonon, they found Bonon, and this is, again, this says, you know, perhaps it would fit to put in the missing resh. I mean, it's a tachmonis, you know, it's really tough. All you have is this document that's full of holes, and you have to fill in, and you have to suggest what's there. Who was from the Rabbanan? Was it this Rav Tzemach? Was it from the, was it Aaron ben Meir? We're going to see. This Tzemach was in the position of Gaon for 31 years. Generally, the position of Gaon means he taught Talmud, which we're going to see, as he was the Gaon. His children were pushed out of the position, and the aforementioned Aaron ben Moshe ben Meir was Rosh Yeshiva for 17 years. After him, and it goes on to discuss the family. After him, Rav Yitzchok, his son, was Rosh Yeshiva for 2 years. Then Ben Meir, the brother of the aforementioned Rav Aaron Gaon, was Rosh Yeshiva 14 years. This one doesn't have his his name was. After him, Avram, the son of Rav Aaron, was Rosh Yeshiva for 7 years. After him, Aaron HaKohen, who the son of is not clear. After him, Yosef HaKohen, which seems to be the original one, who is a nephew of Rav Aaron, this is Bar Moshe ben Meir, was Rosh Yeshiva for 2 years after him. And it goes on, then Rav Yosha ben Ravram, then Rav Aaron, again, the question mark is, how do you fill in the gaps, was for 30 years after him, Shmuel, Rav Yosef HaKohen, perhaps. This is Israel. This is all Israel. Who was Rosh Yeshiva? Evidently, we know from this document there was this Rav Tzemach HaNossi, who was the Rosh Yeshiva before Rav Aaron. His children claimed that they should have the position. Rav Aaron ben Meir pushed them out. This document tells us no inkling why he pushed them out. We do have on page 5, though, from another document in the Genizim. And these are the families of the house of David, David HaMelech, from Tzemach HaNossi, the Rosh Yeshiva, sounds familiar, Ben Yosha Ben Shol Ben Anan Ben David. Anan was the founder of the Karoyim. And it would seem the Tzemach HaNossi, the Rosh Yeshiva, was a descendant of the Karoyim. If he's a Karoy, how is he Rosh Yeshiva is a question. In the lecture that we had about the Karoyim, we see the system of Anan, the halachic system, was a very different system than the traditional Talmudic system. He had a whole different Shulchan Aruch. Not even based on our thing. It was like he took the Chumash and reinterpreted it on his own. For his grandson, great-grandson, to be Rosh Yeshiva would mean that actually his great-grandson was actually a follower in the halachic system, at least, of the Talmud. Otherwise, he couldn't be a Rosh Yeshiva. he may have had Karaite leanings, and his sons more so, which means to say, which would be akin, perhaps, we know that there are different types of Talmudic scholars. They're alive today and the last few generations before us. Most Talmudic scholars we call traditional scholars. And they study Talmud in the traditional way. But there are critical scholars of the Talmud. They do not believe, these critical scholars, that the authors of the Talmud had any special, either Masorah had any special transmission, nor were they specially gifted in the sense of Ruach HaKodesh, of the Holy Spirit. They view them as individuals open to criticism. They don't believe in the validity of the Torah Shebaal Peh, but they are Talmudic scholars. You may not be comfortable eating in their homes, but they do have tremendous scholarship. And perhaps the Tzemach HaNasi, well, we don't have to follow the Talmudic system, but was not divorced from the leanings of his grandfather, who created this Karaite movement, was a Karaite sympathizer, meaning he did not believe in the authenticity and the sanctity of the Torah Shebaal Peh, but accepted it as a halachic system. Because, as we pointed out, the halachic system that Anan created was almost too severe and really fell into disuse, and it was like meshuga. I mean, it was the chumras that he created on his own, based on his whole interpretation, was something that finally his followers abandoned. And it could very well be that what we're dealing with is Talmudic scholars that are apokorsim, you know, that are really they feel it because they believe in a halachic system. Very much perhaps like would be this is the scholars from the Jewish Theological Seminary, or at least before the split, and it was when they really had true scholars. There were scholars, but still their view of the Torah Shebaal Peh and the sanctity of the Torah Shebaal Peh was more similar to that of the Karoyim. And again, I'm only theorizing this, all we have is fragments, but at least the coincidence of having the same name, and it's called Tzemach, he's called, this person is Tzemach HaNasi v'Rosh Yeshiva, in both documents would tend to say that they're the same person. And therefore the Rabbanan is saying that this, on the previous document, this Rav Aaron ben Moshe ben Meir was of the Rabbanan versus not the Karoyim. And this is the term used to describe the two groups. We have the idea, this confirms the idea of the nature of this struggle, was really the struggle of the Karoyim versus the Rabbanan in the next document, which we found in the Genizon, is on page 5 in paragraph B. Here, this is Rav Aaron ben Meir is asking for help, it seems, from the community in Babylon to exercise the influence they had with the caliph, with the Arabic ruler, that the Rabbanan should have the upper hand here. It was a matter of politics to use their help. And in this, it's an amazing story. You should keep in mind, says, why should you help us? You know, we're so far away. Keep in mind, we've sacrificed our lives for the Jewish people. This is our way and the way of our forefathers. And it goes on, the fifth point is, he gives a list why you should help us. We are descendants of Rav Musia, who was killed in the synagogue courtyard by the descendants of Anan. The fight led to bloodshed. And we are the descendants of our fathers, Rav Meir and Rav Moshe. As we said, his name was Rav Anan ben Moshe ben Meir. On many occasions, the enemies desired to kill them. This is Rav Meir and Rav Moshe. But Shakai Hashem acted on their behalf for the sake of his name. So you know, who are our descendants? They're people that were Moser Nefer, sacrificed their lives for the Torah. The sixth point is, we are part of the community upon which many, First was the individuals he was descended from. Now it's our community as a whole. We're part of the community which had many terrible difficulties of past, including imprisonment, torture, chaining, and flogging almost to the point of death from the hands of the descendants of Anan, our enemies. And again, remember, the Semach HaNasi was a descendant of Anan. We have come for help through Hashem, our God, and through you. Act with kindness, and your reward will be from Hashem. And evidently, in his securing of Aaron, this is Ben Meir's, in order for him to secure his position as Rosh Yeshiva against the sons of this of Semach HaNasi, he needed the help of the Babylonians. And not only did he write, but it seems that he went to Babylon also. And this is on the bottom of page 5. For a while, we're going to discuss the rest of this letter, but he was saying, for a while we were in Baghdad with you. He refers this letter to the fact that this is a letter written from Rav Aaron ben Meir to the scholars in Baghdad. He says, when we were in Baghdad, as in Babylon, with you, as we do the following. Rav Aaron ben Meir evidently was a fighter. And he was successful in pushing out the Karoyim, the descendants of Anan, that he, and as we saw from the first fragment, that he and his descendants and his family had that position of Rosh Yeshiva and existed all the way. It was in the hands of the Rabbonim, not necessarily his family, but in the hands of the Rabbonim all the way to the Crusades, where the entire community was wiped out. It was in the year 1096. But up until that point, this is from the year, this is the year 920 something, or 915, until, as we have, well over 150 years, till 1096, it was already in the hands of the Rabbonim, not the Karoyim. He himself, we know from other documents in the Cairo Geniza, was a descendant of Hillel, the famous Hillel in the dynasty of the Nisim. There's even though that again, by the 5th century, the position of Nasi had fallen to disuse, but the prestige of that family continued on. He was a descendant of that family. This final letter, as we've discussed with Aaron ben Meir becoming Rosh Yeshiva and his family after him, but this letter really deals with another controversy, which I'll try to explain, which is a little more difficult. First, just let's read the letter together. So while we're in Baghdad with you, again, and we're saying ostensibly it seems he came to Baghdad for help, we did not refrain from helping you. This letter that Rav Aaron ben Meir is sending to Baghdad to scholars is, he's asking them for help. And he says, why should you help me? Because I've helped you. When I was in Baghdad, it was a two-way thing. I came for the intercession of the Babylonians with the Arab Caliph, but I helped you out. And I want that favor returned. We did not refrain from helping you with all our heart, with all our soul, against those that came together against you. And it continues on about now he explains his own problems, Rav Aaron ben Meir's, that he needs their help, about the scholars of Baghdad. In these days we've received all the letters that David, the prince, Ben Zakkai, which we've learned about him in a previous lecture, this David Ben Zakkai is the one who fought against Rav Sadia Gaon. So we've received all the letters that he wrote. He is the one who was so well known by you for his good deeds and pure ways. We're going to see this is written sarcastically. He wants their help. He's not building up the opposition. The people giving him trouble said he's so, why should they help him? Evidently, they also don't have a very positive view of him, and this was written very sarcastically. He, together with the Kohen, we'll see who that is, and the person who has joined them, Sadia ben Yosef al-Datsli. This is the person who later, 6 years later, became Rav Sadia Gaon. But Rav Sadia just joined them, and I want you, Babylonian scholars, to help me against them. Rav Aharon ben Meir is asking for help. We'll see what the nature of that conflict was. And the people that are bothering me that I need your help for are three people. Deva ben Zakkai, which I know you hold in great, sarcastically, you hold of him very highly. The Kohen, we'll see who that is. And Sadia ben Yosef. These three are giving me problems. I want you to help me out. What was the, in the beginning of the letter, he refers, I helped you out with your problem. What problem would they have had with Rav Dovid ben Zakkai? And to this we have to turn to the letter of Rav Shrira Gaon, which we've quoted very often in the past. In his letter, he speaks of a dispute in the yeshiva Pumpadisa between the Rosh Yeshiva Rav Mavasar Gaon and the Reish Galusa, was the exilarch, Dovid ben Zakkai. Rav Mavasar was the Gaon, and Reish Galusa wanted to put somebody else in his place. That was Kohen Tzedek. That's the Kohen referred to. It seems we know from a different source Kohen Tzedek was a relative of his. When Rav Yehuda Gaon, this is the grandfather of Rav Shrira, died in the year 916, the Rabbanan of the Yeshiva Pompadisa chose Rav Mavasar. They felt he was the greatest scholar, the one was fit to be the next Gaon. Dovid ben Zakkai chose Kohen Tzedek, which was from another source. He was his relative. These strained relations between the year 916 existed until the end of the summer of 921, for 5 years. The yeshiva then, they came to a final, right? The yeshiva had split into two. This is a compromise. Most prestigious scholars attended yeshiva were Mavasar, and the lesser scholars attended Rav Kohen Tzedek. So there became two yeshivas. Eventually, with the death of Rav Mavasar in the winter of 925, the yeshiva of Pompadisa merged, again was reunited. This letter seems to be referring to this, to these problems that Rav Aharon ben Meir, while he was in Baghdad, seems to have sided with the party of Rav Mavasar Gaon, and that's why when he's referring to Rav Dovid ben Zakkai and the Kohen, he felt that these are buzzwords, so to speak, that he could get help from the other side. Of course, Rav Sadia was an unknown, because Rav Sadia originally came from Egypt, was in Israel for some 5 years. 6 years, had just come to Babel. But those two words evidently were lightning words, and he felt, Rav Aharon, that he could get the help with this new controversy. So we spoke of the original controversy that he had, Rav Aharon ben Meir, with the Karoyim, with the descendants of Anan, the other sect, the heretical sect. Now he's involved in a new machlokas. But this machlokas had nothing to do with heresy and had nothing to do with politics. It really had to do with what is the correct way of creating the Jewish calendar. And I would like briefly, if I can, to give you a crash course in creating a Hebrew calendar. This was really the subject of a lecture we had early on in the history series. But if you'll bear with me, it'll make this disagreement all the more understandable. On page 6, in shuls, remember on Shabbos when they bench Rosh Chodesh, when they proclaim the new moon, they announce when the new moon will begin. And it's done in days. In other words, it will be Monday afternoon at 2 o'clock, and so many chalokim, so many units. The units of the hour, there's 1,080 units, chalokim, which is 3 1/3 seconds. So it's divided, in this system, is divided not in seconds but into chalokim. It's 3 1/3 seconds. That's the first thing to keep in mind. Second thing is the lunar month according to the Jewish halachic astronomical system, is 29 days, 12 hours, and 793 chalokim, which is equivalent of would be 12 hours, 44 minutes, and 3 1/3 seconds. That's in from 1 month to the next. The difference between 1 month and the next, then, in terms of days, what day of the week will it fall on? In other words, if they call Rosh Chodesh, you know, if you know what last month's Moilad is, the Moilad is going to be so much and so much. And this day, you want to know, what is it going to be next month? It'll be 1 day, 12 hours, and 793 chalokim pushed. In other words, for theoretically, if the Moilad is in the beginning of Motzoi Shabbos, it's the beginning of Saturday night, the next Moled will be, it's 1 day, so we got a whole all of Sunday, then 12 hours, so it's already Monday, so it'll be in 12 hours into Monday. If we can, according again to the Jewish system, a day starts again at 6 o'clock in the evening, like from 6. So 6 ago, so 12 hours passed already, now it's Monday, 6 in the morning, and 793 chalokim. And that's how it keeps on going. So if you happen to know when the Moilad is 1 year, you know, all you have is 1 day, and you're the gabbai of the shul, and you're the one who has to announce it, and all you're given 1 month, knowing this, you know, on a pencil and paper, you can figure out all the succeeding ones. The length of a standard 12-month lunar year, this is number 4, is 354 days, 8 hours, and 876 chalokim. That's the length of the lunar year. Since there's 793 chalokim, you know, this lunar thing, so that everything now is just a multiple of that. The difference between 1 year and the next, therefore, again, the difference meaning in terms of the day of the thing, again, if 1 year it's at the beginning, it's Saturday night, and Motzoi Shabbos is the beginning, the next one will fall out next year, is 4 days, 8 hours, and 876 chalokim further in. Right, which will come out after 4 days and 8 hours, which is the fifth day, will come out on Thursday, you know, the first 1 year is Motzoi Shabbos, the next one will be Thursday. Yeah, the difference between Nisan and Tishrei, which is half a year, according to this, is 2 days, 4 hours, and 438 chalokim. That's half of that. That's a regular year, but not all years are regular years. There's an Iber year, in other words, the year which is 13 months. In the 13th month of the year, then the length of the year is 383 days, 21 hours, and 589 chalokim. And according to this, then the difference between 1 year and the next will be, because after we divide into seven, after we finish with multiples of seven, it will be pushed in. Again, the difference between Moled of one and the next is 5 days, 21 hours, and 589 chalokim. In addition, just know, in every 19-year cycle, the way our system is created now, there's an Iber Yor in the years 3, 6, 8, 11, 14, 17, and 19, 7 years altogether. Let me just summarize that part of that, just very quickly, what we've covered till now. That there are divisions of chalokim. There's 1,080 chalokim in an hour, which is equal to 3 1/3 seconds. The lunar month, this is really it all, everything is a multiple of that. Once you know this, what the lunar month is, everything is just simple multiplication. The lunar month is 29 days, 12 hours, 793 chalokim. This is really mentioned in the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, and it says in Chofei Amud Aleph, this figure. Then afterwards, everything is just multiplying it. Once you have 12, the standard 12-month one is 12 times that, which comes out to 354 days, 8 hours, and 76 chalokim. And in the Ibra Yorah, you divide it, you multiply not by 12, but by 13, you get 383 days, 21 hours, 589 chalafim. Now, in terms of how we've calculated, how we know, what's the basis of when the new moon, the sighting will be, or not the sighting, when is the calculation of the new moon, 1 month, is really based on a given, which the Tosfos quotes this in Rosh Hashanah, because the new moon of the first actual year occurred on Friday, 14 hours into the day, which is 8 o'clock. And there's, again, 6 o'clock p.m. is the beginning of a day, sunset. So based on that, so 14 hours is 8 p.m. If that's the first molad, you know, then everything else is calculated from there. The first, also in addition, just the first 5 days of creation are counted as another calendar year. In other words, actually, that Friday when man came onto this world is not the first day of the creation story. It's the sixth day. There are 5 days before that. Those 5 days, for calculation purposes, are called the first year. In other words, you go to Bornstein's and you get a calendar, and it says this year is 5,700, right? And this is in 59. What it means to say is this year is this is the 5,759th year. It means 5,758 years have passed, and as is, we're only in the 59th year, right? How many years have passed? Those years that have passed, this is the astronomical calendar. The Bornstein's calendar, the astronomical calendar, is the first year of this year was at 5, that's mini year. The first year number 1 was a 5-day year. When Adam HaRishon, man, came onto this, he was born, or came into it, in year number 2. 1 year, that 5 days, again, this is all calculation purposes. This is why accountants are so good. So these 5 days are a whole year. Now we're starting the new, you know, your new fiscal year starts of creation. But in terms of calculating years, according to our calculations, he was born on Rosh Hashanah, the first day of Tishrei. The creation was on the 25th day of Elul. Again, this is all for calculating. There's no error.
Fifth, sixth day was a Friday. Part
of that day would be the year before, part of that
day would be the year later?
No. Well, we'll count that. Since the Molad is then, this whole day is Tishrei. The whole day is Tishrei, but this whole day already is... That's right. Okay. So all the years have passed, the first year is this 5-day year. Now this is only a 5-day year. However, we artificially construct, if that year had been not 5 days, but 354 days, when would the Molad have occurred? It didn't occur then. But when would it have occurred for calculation purposes? That's called Molad Baharad. It would have occurred on Monday, that's Yom Beis, 5 hours into the day. Again, a day starts from 6 o'clock p.m., so it's 11 o'clock p.m., and 204 chalokim, that's Baharad. That's how the system of Molad works. Now, in terms of the actual calendar, months are full days. We don't stop, you know, hey, how many chalokim is the new month stop? You start yet? It's whole days. Months are days. So days are either 29 days in a Hebrew month or 30 days in a Hebrew month. In a normal year, in a common year, we will have, if it will just be a plain year, this 354-day year, the first month, Tishrei, or Nisan, whatever, will be a mole, will be full. Mole means 30 days. The next one, Cheshvan, will be Choser, means a diminished month, that's a 29-day year. So it's 30, 29. If it were exactly, it would be 54, everything would be fine. But we know that it's not exactly 54, it's 54 and 8 hours plus. Right? As we, this came up, this is on this is number 4 on page 6. So there has to be a certain amount of adjustment. And that's why Kislev and Teves are adjustable. If everything is fine, then it keeps the same thing, you know, then Kislev will be Mole, Teves is a Choser. In other words, 30, 29. But for adjustment purposes, sometimes both are 29, and both Choser. Sometimes both are Mole. Sometimes both are full. So sometimes a year can be 353 days, if they're both, you've made both of them 29-day months, Choser. Some days it will be, years will be a 355-day year because both are mole. You can look in the in these in the notes yourself here. There are reasons. I don't know if you've ever noticed. You know, in Shul they'll call up, the Moed is this and this day, and that's not the day Rosh Chodesh comes up. And hey, why shouldn't it come out that way? There are several reasons why it does not come out the new moon, the month, an actual, does not come out when the new moon came out. There are two major considerations here. One is, I'll just be on page 7, one of those considerations is that even though theoretically, they call the Moed is, let's say the Moed is going to be 12:01 on Tuesday, in the afternoon. If it comes out 12:01, according to the Gemara, at least the simple reading of the Gemara, it will not be visible for 6 hours. So astronomically, I know this is the new moon, but there's with common eyesight, one cannot see the new moon. It's too small to see until 6 hours have passed. If it's not sightable, then Besdin does not make it that day. So even if they will, if we say the Moed is 12:01, it's 12:01 in the afternoon on Tuesday, but Rosh Chodesh would, with no other factors, would be Wednesday, because it has to be sightable. Can't see it. That's called Moled Zoken, an old Moled Al Tidrosh. It's too, it's not, you only notice it in retrospect, not when you see the next day. Ah, see, it must have been a Moled. You don't see it fresh. At the sighting, when you see it, it's yesterday's Moled. It's no good. At the sighting, you have to be able to see today's Moled. You can't see it for the next 6 hours. So even though that is called the Moled, in fact, it will not be the Rosh Chodesh. That's one factor. The next factor is there are 3 days that Rosh Hashanah cannot fall out of. It's called Lo Adu Rosh. That's the siman. Adu. Aleph, it can't fall out on a Sunday. It can't fall, Dalet, it can't fall out on a Wednesday. And Vav, it can't fall out on Friday. It can't fall out on any of these days. So Lo Adu, Lo Adu Rosh. The Rosh can't be Adu. The reasons are, at least some of the reasons are, if you have on page 7, if Yom Kippur would fall out either on Friday or on Sunday, someone who died, one of those days, would not be able to be buried for 2 days. It's not COVID on mace. It'll be 2 days would pass. So therefore they want to make sure that we don't have Yom Kippur next to Shabbos. Well, if Yom Kippur falls out on Friday, which we don't want it to fall, that means Rosh Hashanah was Wednesday. So therefore we will not make Rosh Hashanah Wednesday. We will adjust the calendar. We'll push it up. We will not have it Wednesday. If Rosh Hashanah is Friday, that means Yom Kippur is going to be Sunday. Again, we don't want the two Shabbos Yom Kippur coming together. Also, we will push it away. Push it. Also, if it happens, Rosh Hashanah comes out on Sunday, there are different reasons why, the part of this display this more, why we push it aside. One of the reasons that is not brought down here is if it falls out on Sunday, then Hoshana Rabbah will come out on Shabbos. And we don't take Hoshanas on Shabbos, therefore that year there won't actually be the celebration of Hoshana Rabbah, the Hoshanas, of taking the willow, and therefore it's pushed us away so we can celebrate the taking of the Hoshanas. So that's for those, we can't have it those days. The present, on page 8, the present system that we have is based on the system of Hillel ben Rabbi Yehuda. This is taken from, again, this is a tshuva of Rav Haigon, which is quoted by later authorities. In the year 359, our present calendar, the system was set into motion. They used many of the same considerations, but there was still more wiggle room. But it's this predictable thing that I know it's going to happen only years, the Iber Yor, year 3, 6, 8, 11, 14, 17, and 19, was something which was set up then. Before that, the Iber Yor was not predictable. This is what the intercalated year, that extra month, the 13th month year, was not predictable. Based on all of that, right? Now you got it all clear. Yeah. Based on all of that, I want to explain a problem that really that came up, which was really the source of all these problems, this great controversy. According to the Talmud, and this is what the Babylonian scholars maintained, if it would be 12:01 in the afternoon, you got to push it to the next day. According to Rav Aaron ben Meir, though, he had a tradition that if it was 641 chalukim, remember, a chalik is 3 1/3 second, it's 641 chalukim after chatzos, it'll still be visible. If it falls out on 12 o'clock and 641 chalukim, it'll still be visible on that same day. And the Gemara that says it's 6 hours is imprecise. So therefore, it says, and it's the mnemonic, it's the word omarta. Word omarta, you have said, omarta 641. You have this wiggle room of 641. So according to the tradition which we hold to this day, it would be 1201. 12 o'clock, and one chalik, you just push it, one chalik, it's the next day. According to Aaron ben Meir, based on his tradition, no, you don't push it away. You still have some time. It'll still be visible before nightfall. You call it this day. And what brought things to a head, and this is what we're going to say, if you look on page 8, you see all the Hebrew writing in the middle. In the year 923, this is Tuf Resh Pei Dalet, the year 923, the Molad came out on Shabbos afternoon, not 1201, but 237 Chalukim afternoon. Now, it's 237 afternoon. According to the traditional way, this is the simple reading of the Talmud and how the Babylonian scholars understood this, 237 chalukim, well, you gotta, it's not visible today, it has to be tomorrow. According to Aaron ben Meir, no, it's still visible, you still have this omarta, you still have these 641 chalukim, the Talmud is imprecise, it isn't exactly 6 hours, a little, you still have this room, as long as it's within this window of opportunity, this omarta, you're all set. How does that affect the calendar here? Look on page 8, on this bottom here. According to Aaron ben Meir, that's this on the right hand column, Rosh Hashanah Tishrei, look all the way down, is Yom Zion. This is in the far right side. Now turning further though on the left hand columns, the Chachmei Bavel, if their Rosh Hashanah came out on Yom Beis, it came out on Monday. Why? Why the discrepancy? Because it can't fall out on Shabbos, because we say even 12:01 you got to push it. But it can't fall out on Sunday either. Le'ad du Rosh. So we got to push it past Sunday, we got to push it to Monday. That's a big difference. And that difference came out, as we're going to see, is not only for Rosh Hashanah, which made a big difference, how they're going to celebrate Rosh Hashanah of the year, of that year, Tofresh Pei Dalet, but it affected all the holidays between the year Tofresh Pei Beis, which is the year 921, and this period of 923. During this whole period, the holidays were affected. Let me just give you an inkling of why that is so. This is between, and again, the time doesn't allow for a full exposition here. Why does this cost unless we go over an hour and a half? Between Rosh Hashanah and Pesach, there are just 2 days. We said there's a difference that we can make. Kislev or Teves, and we could change them. That's in the winter. But in the summer, every month is predicted. Nisan is mole, Iyar is choser, Sivan is mole, Tammuz is choser, Av is mole, Elul is choser. And the difference of 2 days. Therefore, if, according to if in Tofresh Pei Dalet, in 923, Rosh Hashanah is going to come out on Shabbos, according to Rav Meir, 2 days before, that Pesach is going to come out on Thursday. According to the Chachmei Bavel, the scholars of Babylon, the 2 days before Monday comes out on Shabbos. Well then, Pesach, if Rosh Hashanah is different, Pesach is different. For various reasons, the time doesn't allow in order to adjust for the difference in this calendar between if it's going to be Yom Beis, their changes had to be made in the Pesach Nisan already of Tofresh Pei Beis in 922. So the differences between them was how Pesach was going to be in 922, how Rosh Hashanah was going to be in 922, how Pesach was going to be in 923, and Rosh Hashanah in 923. There are 4 days, you can look at this, there's a discrepancy of 4 months of holidays. Well, that's a big difference. Rav Sadia, while he was in Eretz Yisrael, disagreed with this Aaron ben Meir, and Aaron ben Meir felt that he was right, and he pushed this through. As a result, and this controversy, and this is what the letter that he was asking for help from the other Babylonian authorities, what came out was the majority of Jews in Eretz Yisrael followed Aaron ben Meir's rulings, at least for the first Pesach, and it was the first time of 922's Passover. The majority of the Babylonians followed the Babylonian ruling. There was a minority in both camps, though, that followed the other ruling. I mean, one thing that keeps Jews together is the calendar. So it's not a question of just who's right and wrong, but it's really creating two separate communities. How did Aaron ben Meir come to this, what we view today as a mistake? So there's a tshuva we have from Rav Shrira Gon, Rav Hai Gon, which is printed on the bottom of page 8, that he explains that his error was, yes, there is a place for this thing, Omarta, but he placed it wrong. And he says as follows here, and this is in the bold print. He says, the Chachmei Bavel, Babylonian scholars maintain, when it says at 12 o'clock there's a 6 hour thing, it can't, if it follows after 6 it can't be seen, that's what it means. How did he make the mistake, Aaron ben Meir? So he's looking at the bullpen. The difference between Nisan and Tishrei is 2 days, 4 hours, and 438 halakim. That's the difference. If I want to know what Nisan is, And I want to know, hey, wait a minute, is the following Tishrei, is it the marriage going to be seen or not? Is it going to follow after by Chatzos or not? If they announced in Shul that the Molad of Nisan is 1 hour, that would be 7 o'clock, and 641 Chalokim, that's how they announced it in Shul. If I add, which I know is going to be 2 days, 4 hours, and 438 Chalokim, if I add the 4 hours and 438 Chalokim to that, I know says that it will still occur before noon. Because when you add 4 hours and 438 halakim to 1 hour, which we say if the sighting is 1 hour, and there's any time it's 1 hour, 641 halakim, or before that, if it's at least maximize this, and you add 4 hours and 438 halakim, which is going to be the difference between, if I know something in Nisan, what is it going to happen in Tishrei, I'm still safe. Because you add them together, you just get 5 hours, 1,079 halakim. However, if you're past Amarta, it's 642 halakim, so it comes out of the Nisan, it comes out in the daytime, it's 1 hour and 642 halakim, I know that it's going to be Chatzos, it's going to be noon time in Tishrei. Well, noontime, you're not going to see it that day. Well, then you'll have to push it forward. So the Omarta that he was according to him, was the Aaron ben Meir confused, was not how to define Tishrei, but rather, if you know Nisan and it's 1 hour and Omarta in Nisan, you know you'll be safe for Tishrei and you won't have to push it forward. If it's beyond that, if it's beyond 7 o'clock, if they announce in Shul it's 7 o'clock at 642 Chalakim, you know Tishrei will have to be moved forward. That is, you can look at this again, that was Aaron ben Meir's error. There they have it. We found in the archives of the Geniza a fascinating, you can look at this as a fascinating letter, which the scholars of Babylon, and perhaps those are the scholars he originally wrote to, who were friendly with him, and this is written in a very friendly tone, explained to Aaron ben Meir how Aaron ben Meir, made a mistake. And in the letter, they come to counter his points. His points is, well, Eretz Yisrael, we know from the Gemara, was the place that the calendar was decided. Well, I'm the Rosh Hashiva of Eretz Yisrael. I've decided this is how the calendar is going to be, and that's the way it's going to be. So they very politely explained to him that it was only the place where things were decided when the Beis Din in Eretz Yisrael was the one who set it up, but not today. Because it's already been set up. We're just calculating it. The place of Eretz Yisrael, because they had to do with this was the place because it had to deal with the harvest and the climatic conditions. It was set based on Eretz Yisrael, but it has nothing to do with calculations. Second, which is a fascinating thing, we spoke about scholarship in Eretz Yisrael, and he says, this is on the second paragraph on page 11, certainly the rabbis of Babylon, the earlier generations, would send emissaries and inquire from our rabbis in Eretz Yisrael regarding the setting of the months of the year. Because originally, Eretz Yisrael had a preeminence of the calendar calculations. This is because we're not experts in the system of Eber as we are today. That is why they would write to them. This is as there were years past that the Babylonian scholars would go to the Israeli scholars. However, many years have passed since a large number of scholars from Babylon went up to Eretz Yisrael and carefully studied the Sod HaIbur, and there's the secret of the calculation, and thoroughly investigated to the point they were experts in the field themselves and could determine the months by themselves. So it really, it's interesting that there was a period of time that Israel had predominance, no longer. And third, they go on to explain that he made this error in this Omarta, which is the rest of this letter. But it's a fascinating subject. Eventually, though, Rav Sadia and Rav Dovid ben Zakkai, Rav Kohen Tzedek prevailed, and the system is as we know it today. Rav Aaron ben Meir was a fighter, someone who fought against the Karoyim and was successful, who, though we view he made an error, he felt he was in the right and tried his utmost to win in the calendar controversy. By contrast, a successor of his...
Did he get
all the credit? Well, all we know is from the little that was left in the Geniza. The fact is, it doesn't seem that we don't have any more letters after these dates, and it seems that the Babylonian scholars prevailed. We know of a Gaon in a later period, who was a contemporary of Haigon, Rav Shlomo ben Yehuda, who was had a different personality. In fact, he was in very good relations with the Karoyim. But he was the Rosh Yeshiva. He sent his son to learn by Rav Haigon, the Shlomo ben Yehuda. And it's just interesting to see the difference between them. And he says, I wish that someone who is on page 13, who's fit and worthy, would come and I would be put him in my place, as occurred in the early generations. I'd like to be relieved of this. He was the master of sheep. The Hashem was the master of Israel, should establish shepherds for them that he deems worthy, so they can guide them with knowledge and understanding. As he says, really, I'm doing this out of default. And he goes on, on the bottom of page 13, my whole desire and wish is for peace amongst Jews. It's revealed to Hashem that if money would be sent to the yeshiva that would have been the product of communal strife, I would not take it. This is an amazing person. Because again, he was not a descendant of Rav Aaron Meir. In fact, he was really not of that family at all. But he was a little that we have of him, you know, that we see as an unusual individual. I would just like to briefly end off, and you could see this in your own time. We've discussed before that how Hebrew became the language in Eretz Yisrael. And not only was the Hebrew language used, but it was studied. It refers to the Anshei Tveria, those who were in Tveria, Hatzachen, Beloshen, Ivrim. This is Rav Yonas Ibn Mejanach, one of the great grammarians, describing those in Tveria know the Hebrew language. And it was in Tveria, really, it was a renaissance of not only the Hebrew language, but uncovering the exact text and the reading of the text that we have are from the work of those scholars. The Gemara describes, and the Gemara Kedushin, Lamed Aleph, describes the fact that they did not have accurate texts in terms of mole and chaser. There were their words with a vav or without a vav, with a yud, without a yud. The scholars of Tiberias worked upon this. And he says, I have seen, so look on top of page 14, I've seen swarm that were checked by the scholars of Tiberias, upon which 15 of their elders swore that each word, Nekuda, Mole, and Chaser, had been thoroughly looked over 3 times. This is written by Ibn Ezra. The Rambam Sefer Torah is based on the Sefer Torah of Tiberias, which is the Sefer Torah of Ben Osher. Ben Osher was the greatest of the Tiberian scholars, whose authority, by and large, is accepted, is really the Sefer Torah that we use is Ben Osher's Sefer Torah. There were other competing Sefer Torahs. The other, his competitor, so to speak, of Ben Osher, his name was Aaron Ben Moshe Ben Osher, Ben Osher being the family name, was Moshe Ben Naphtali. There are various discrepancies between them. By and large, we've accepted Ben Osher's. On rare occasions, we've accepted, it says, Ben Naphtali. One of them is how you read the word Yisachar. According to Ben Osher, it's Yisachar. Very often, on the first time it's introduced in the Torah, the Baal Korah will say the word Yisachar, Yisachar. This is Ben Osher's reading. Our reading is based on Ben Naphtali, which is Yisachar. There are scholars that may claim that Ben Naphtali's really source is really from the Babylonian Masorah, whereas Ben Usher's is the Eretz Yisrael Dika Masorah, but it's Ben Usher's Masorah, his thing, that actually is Kaveya the Halacha. This was, again, all from the scholarship in Eretz Yisrael. There was two things. One was the Chosser and the Mole, and there are slight differences. In Svarna, there's only one difference of the Hay and Alam Suadaka. But by and large, they've accepted the Sefer Torah of Ben Usher, and his has been accepted. But again, it's through the work of many generations of scholars of Tveria that the final, they came really what they felt is uncovering, we just have the original Sefer Torah and the original way of how to pronounce this, how the Nikud works. We do know, though, that the Talmud quotes readings that we do not have, and in terms of Mole and Chosser, and Rashi quotes readings we don't have. Because Rashi's, I guess, the acceptance of Ben Usher's Sefer Torah was not something which was accepted in the place of Rashi until much later. But there were, again, these are very slight discrepancies, but there were... That's right. That's right. This is a Mole, is it a Chosser? And Rashi makes it on mezuzos. He says this is mezuzah, he made their drushas based on readings that we don't have. Because he was really, this is the pre-Ben Usher Sefer Torah.
This wasn't the question of how to read a letter, it was the question of how to read a word. Like, for instance, I put the word gimel.
Yeah, that's not.
How to read the word, no matter how you read it.
That's right, exactly. It seems in Eretz Yisrael there are three basic communities in Yerushalayim, which came to be after the Muslim conquest. The Jews weren't allowed in Yerushalayim before that. In Tveria and in Gaza. No, because this is after the Crusades. That was after the Crusades. But before the Crusades, it was a viable, vibrant community. They had the problems within the community because of the Karoyim, as they, after they became a major Karaite center. And many times it was very difficult. Also, that the Israel originally was controlled by the caliphs of Baghdad, but eventually broke off and was controlled by those of Egypt. And those of Egypt were Shiites. In fact, the founder of the Druze was a rabid anti-Semite. That seems to be someone who is insane. And he made life very, very difficult for Jews in Eretz Israel. So they had their difficulties during different periods. But they seem to have produced tremendous works, even after the Perushim we have on Talmud. I mean, they're produced by these, even after the period of the Gaonim, in the beginning of the first time when Rashi flourished, there were scholars in yeshivas in Eretz Israel.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237, or call 1-800-797-7729.